This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. Today, my guest is David Goldfield, a history professor at UNC Charlotte and the author of numerous books on the Civil War and race in America. His new book is The Gifted Generation, When Government Was Good. It covers American public policy on equality, housing, jobs, science, and other issues, but in a much more personal and less wonkish manner than I just described it. The heart of The Gifted Generation centers on three presidents who used the power and heft of government to push for greater equality and greater innovation. These presidents, Truman, Eisenhower, and Johnson, in their own ways pushed up against public opinion and large numbers of stubborn and often nativist, racist, and sexist members of Congress to advance the nation. Professor Goldfield makes a strong case, with numbers to support his thesis, showing that America fares best when the federal government is robust and ambitious. At the same time, the gifted generation makes clear the costly loss of confidence in government over the last 50 years. Both parties, Republicans and Democrats, share the blame, Goldfield believes. Here to do nothing less than solve the nation's problems, David Goldfield, welcome to Charlotte Talks.
Thanks, Eric. Good to be here. I'm not sure I'm going to fulfill your promo over there, but we'll try.
So this book is interesting because you not only have the analytical and anecdotal big picture historical overview, but you also include the experiences of your classmates from Samuel Tilden High School in Brooklyn as examples of how major government programs helped people improve their lives. So what led you to that particular approach?
In 2011, we held our 50th class reunion, and what struck me about the people who were there, that they had led very diverse careers, even numerous careers within one individual, and they wound up in jobs that did not exist when we were in high school. But all of them benefited from federal programs, whether it was subsidizing their graduate education, NDEA fellowships, whether it was through the GI Bill, whether it was support after they got out in terms of research grants and work in biology or even in the social sciences. This was a significant thread that ran through the lives of these individuals. And I was thinking, my kids, and they don't have that government activism that we had. We grew up believing that government had our backs, that government would provide us with opportunities, not give us things, but provide us with opportunities to do well. Of course, there were failures along the way, but at least we grew up in an atmosphere where anything was possible. Polio, that great scourge of summer, was solved. We put a man on the moon. What couldn't we do? Most of the antibiotics that were discovered between 1940s and 1950s, all subsidized with government assistance. Measles, mumps, these childhood diseases were virtually eradicated. So we were living better lives because of the federal government. The government leveled the playing field. We had much less income inequality. We had much greater opportunity. But most of all, we had governments through these three presidents that adhered to the founding ideals of our nation, particularly that embodied in the Declaration of Independence. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. So we had a time in America when African Americans became, at least legally, full citizens, where women became, at least legally, full citizens, where immigrants and the sons and daughters of immigrants became full citizens. And many of us in that 50th anniversary group of Tilden High School students, many of us were first or second generation immigrants. Tilden High School had a population of 5,000. It was a large high school. Population of 5,000, and 97.4% of these students were either Jewish or Italian. So in fact, throughout my whole high school career, I think I met one Protestant. But we all knew that it was white Protestant men who ruled the country. And we, most of us, Italian or Jewish, we had experienced the prejudice that went along with that. We knew the hotels we couldn't stay at. We knew the neighborhoods we couldn't buy homes in. We knew the country clubs that we couldn't be members in. We knew the institutions of higher education that impose quotas on Jews and Italians. We knew all this. And we also knew that in order to beat this, in order to become part of this great country, we would not only have to match these white Protestant men, we would have to exceed them.
Again, we're speaking with Professor David Goldfield from UNC Charlotte. His new book is called The Gifted Generation, When Government Was Good. Related to your high school specifically, you mentioned that your alma mater closed in 2010, and you described it as, quote, a metaphor and indictment of our public policy during the past 40 years. So you just outlined all the things that were going on then that were to the greater good. What's been left out in those 40 years?
High schools, particularly in New York, but in many other cities, reflect their neighborhoods. And neighborhoods, to some extent, reflect public policy in housing, public policy in infrastructure, and above all, public policy in education. Beginning in the 1980s, the federal government began to withdraw from these types of activities, from these types of supports for education, for infrastructure, for housing. And at the same time, in these neighborhoods where the first and second generation immigrants lived, they moved out, and a more dependent group or groups moved in. And ironically, just as they needed more of these support services from government, government began to withdraw. And you got the perfect storm. You got the deteriorating housing. You got the deteriorating infrastructure. You got the decline in education. If you look at Tilden High School, we were a working class neighborhood. Nothing really special about it. But we had families. We had families. We had religious institutions. Our neighborhood was sprinkled with synagogues and Roman Catholic churches. And we had also the support of the government. And together, we not only built a community, but we built our lives.
Let's talk a little bit about President Truman. As you describe in the book, he was from Missouri and came out of what was largely a Southern mindset in many ways, and I'm talking about on racial matters in particular. Yet he pushed hard on civil rights. He was the first president to address the NAACP. Let's hear what he had to say in 1949.
Recent events in the United States and abroad have made us realize that it is more important today than ever before to ensure that all Americans enjoy these rights. When I say all Americans, I mean all Americans. Our immediate task is to remove the last remnants of the barriers which stand between millions of our citizens and their birthright. There is no justifiable reason for discrimination because of ancestry, our religion, our race, our color. We must not tolerate such limitations on the freedom of any of our people and on their enjoyment of basic rights, which every citizen is in a truly democratic society must possess. Every man should have the right to a decent home, the right to an education, the right to adequate medical care, the right to a worthwhile job, the right to an equal share in making the public decisions through the ballot, and the right to a fair trial in a fair court. We must ensure that these rights, on equal terms, are enjoyed by every citizen. To these principles, I pledge my full and continued support.
Where did that come from?
That's a really interesting question, Eric. Considering the fact that, as you indicated, Truman had Confederate roots. Independence, Missouri was a southern town. I mean, it was in a border state, but it was really a southern town. His mom always related the story about how her family, her mom, stomped on a copy of Uncle Tom's Cabin by Harriet Beecher Stowe. And she blamed Abraham Lincoln for all of the economic problems that had befallen.
Long memory.
Long memory. And Harry, who had a really great sense of humor, when his mom came to visit the White House, said, "Mom, I'm going to put you in the Lincoln bedroom." And mom said, "I'd just as soon sleep on the floor." So he had this background. But he also had this sense, also ironically from his mom, of fairness, that people should be judged not by the color of their skin but the content of their character. And from his early days in Independence, Missouri, when he first ran for office in Jackson County, he talked with the relatively small black community there, and he was certain when programs were funded that African Americans got their share, their fair share. So from the beginning of his political career, he had this sense of fairness. This doesn't mean that he didn't use the N-word. He certainly did. This doesn't mean he may have been a little uncomfortable about racial integration, but it does mean that he had this sense of fairness. In other words, he overcame his background, but it was a background steeped in religion, particularly the golden rule, do unto others. And he was very, very much aware of the trends in America at that time. And I think one of the most important turning points in his thinking was the Second World War and how African-American soldiers put their lives on the line for rights that they did not have at home.
That was Professor David Goldfield, obviously from UNC Charlotte. He's the author of the new book, The Gifted Generation, When Government Was Good. And when we come back, we're going to ask him a little bit about where JFK might have gotten off to in this new book and other details about the post-World War II American economy. All that and more when we come back on Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins.
Our conversation on the gifted generation continues in a moment here on Charlotte Talks. Author David Goldfield will be at Park Road Books at the Park Road Shopping Center this evening from 7 to 8:30. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Bradley, a full-service law firm with attorneys that are experienced in serving the banking and financial services industry in Charlotte and across the nation. Details at bradley.com. And from Hefner Financial of Charlotte, Jim Hefner is an independent fiduciary financial planner whose team specializes in retirement solutions and tax strategies. Information at youlljustknow.com. On the next Charlotte Talks, the courts have become a frequent destination for North Carolina lawmakers in recent years, from gerrymandering to ongoing spats with the governor. Now the courts themselves have become the focus of legislation. Judicial elections have been tweaked, and more far-reaching changes could be on the horizon. Guest host Michael Bitzer will talk with a Mecklenburg County lawmaker and a former state Supreme Court justice tomorrow morning at 9 here on 90.7 WFAE.
Thousands of Puerto Rican students were forced to move to the mainland and settle in new schools. For high school seniors, a big question looms. What happens to my college plans? We'll check in on some students determined to make it.
I'm capable of accomplishing everything I set my mind to.
I'm Elise Hugh, applying for college after Maria, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 to 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
Back on Charlotte Talks with Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins. My guest today is Professor David Goldfield from UNC Charlotte. His new book is called The Gifted Generation, When Government Was Good. And when we stepped away, one of the things I mentioned is JFK, who does not play a prominent role in your book. You go through the Truman, Eisenhower, and Lyndon Johnson presidencies fairly extensively. But there's a chapter in the book that is called Interlude, where you talk about John F. Kennedy and you describe a president whose, quote, timidity on civil rights and meager accomplishments in other domestic policy areas inevitably produced a letdown. That's really interesting for a number of reasons, primarily because I think a lot of people who sort of take a quick glance think of Kennedy as this era of optimism, faith, and belief in government, yet he was not one of these presidents who really moved it in an ambitious, meaningful way. Why do you think he's still thought of in that manner, and yet he was ineffective in many ways?
The image of John F. Kennedy has always been better than the reality, and I think one of the reasons why many people still revere him is the fact that he was assassinated. He was a martyr for our country. And I think this tends to diminish the criticism against him and elevate the meager accomplishments that actually occurred during his administration. He had some very good ideas. And in fact, Lyndon Johnson, when he took over in November of 1963, implemented many of those ideas, including in the area of civil rights. It's just that Kennedy really didn't push these initiatives very much. He was very much concerned with holding the South. Of course, the South historically was solidly Democratic, and he wanted very much to go run for a second term. And that was really his objective, particularly from 1962 to 1963. So in order to hold the South, he had to soft-pedal civil rights. Also, I wondered that Kennedy was not as committed as, say, Truman or Eisenhower to the idea of racial equality. He really got extremely upset at the Freedom Rides. The Freedom Rides, of course, were groups of white and black young men,
including Congressman John Lewis.
Including Congressman John Lewis, took Greyhound and Trailways buses from Washington, D.C. through the South, ultimately hoping to head to New Orleans. And, of course, it got cut short a bit in places like Birmingham and Montgomery.
And Rock Hill.
And Rock Hill, absolutely. So Kennedy was furious. As was his brother Bobby, who was, of course, Attorney General, that they would be stirring this up. He wasn't as furious against the governor of Alabama. He wasn't furious against the Klansmen who attacked the Freedom Riders, but he was furious at the Freedom Riders.
For causing trouble, in other words,
exactly.
In his view, political trouble.
Right. And there was a situation with an African diplomat from Ghana, who drove down from New York to Washington and could not get served in the restaurants in Delaware and Maryland. And Kennedy's reaction was, why didn't he fly? Not that these restaurants should not be segregated, but that he should take a plane.
Wow.
So Kennedy's reputation is well beyond his accomplishments. But again, he did have an agenda, and if he was unsuccessful, and he was unsuccessful in promoting this agenda, Lyndon B. Johnson ran with it.
Yeah, and I want to talk about LBJ and what he did on civil rights, really picking up the mantle from JFK. But I also want to talk about, you know, in the book you emphasize that only the federal government could relieve discrimination against various groups, Catholics, Jews, African-Americans, women, immigrants. How do you reconcile that enormous progress made in the post-World War II era with our continuing and contentious debates today over immigration, police brutality against minorities, sexual harassment, just a few of the things that are in the news right now?
One of the interesting things I discovered is that the same arguments used to restrict immigration in the 1940s, 1950s, and 1960s, the same arguments used to limit gender equality, the same arguments used on a range of issues were pioneered in the 1940s and 1950s. For example, let's take immigration. The knock on expanding immigration in the 1940s and 1950s was that, well, we were going to let in criminals. We're going to let in communists because, you know, those people from Southern and Eastern Europe, who, by the way, were overwhelmingly Roman Catholic and Jewish, had these strange ideas. They really won't assimilate into American society. And if you translate that, it means, well, only Northern Europeans can really assimilate into American society. Also that they would be a burden on our social structure and particularly on finances because they will require so many services that it would just bankrupt communities, states, and ultimately the federal government. So you had the same arguments recycled. In fact, you could just play them back and it would feel very 2017.
Well, and the same thing you go through extensively with starting with Truman on federal health care, and it is declared by its opponents to be socialism, and we certainly hear that argument with the Obama health care.
Exactly. Harry Truman promoted universal health care, and we're still waiting for it. and Truman's ideas were attacked. Particularly by the American Medical Association. And, of course, during the height of the Cold War, to brand anyone a socialist was pretty devastating. That was a very negative comment. And it was successful, and we're still waiting today for universal health insurance.
You, as I mentioned at the top of the show, you've written often in your career about the Civil War. In your new book, you explore the progressive policies of Dwight Eisenhower, obviously a war hero, a Republican president. In 1957, he sent federal troops to Little Rock after the governor defied a legal ruling to desegregate Central High School. Here's what he said then.
But I felt that, in speaking from the House of Lincoln, of Jackson, and of Wilson, my words would better convey both the sadness I feel in the action I was compelled today to make and the firmness with which I intend to pursue this course until the orders of the federal court at Little Rock can be executed without unlawful interference. In that city, under the leadership of demagogic extremists, disorderly mobs have deliberately prevented the carrying out of proper orders from a federal court. Local authorities have not eliminated that violent opposition. And under the law, I yesterday issued a proclamation calling upon the mob to disperse. This morning, the mob again gathered in front of the Central High School of Little Rock, obviously for the purpose of again preventing the carrying out of the court's order relating to the admission of Negro children to that school. Whenever normal agencies prove inadequate to the task, and it becomes necessary for the executive branch of the federal government to use its powers and authority to uphold federal courts, the president's responsibility is inescapable. In accordance with that responsibility, I have today issued an executive order directing the use of troops under federal authority to aid in the execution of federal law at Little Rock, Arkansas.
Why was that decision so important in Eisenhower's presidency?
For one thing, many people opposed it. It was the first time since the Civil War that federal troops had, quote, invaded the South. Even the Saturday Evening Post, which was traditionally a Republican magazine, criticized Eisenhower for not exploring other options than sending troops into Little Rock. The truth of the matter is Eisenhower did explore other options. He met with Arkansas Governor Orville Faubus. He discussed various plans. He discussed various options. But ultimately, what Eisenhower decided is that you cannot, a governor of a state or any official of a state, cannot defy a federal court or order. Above all, we are a nation of laws. We have a constitution, and we have a series of federal laws. And once you start doing that, then you're down the road to anarchy. Eisenhower wanted to make not only a statement, but he also wanted and felt that he was upholding the U.S. Constitution, which, of course, he took an oath of office to protect.
Those are the words of Professor David Goldfield, a history professor at UNCC and the author of the new book, The Gifted Generation, When Government Was Good. Along those lines, with the Arkansas situation in particular, just as a lay reader, I never knew the fascinating background of the governor of Arkansas who had defied Eisenhower. And in many ways, as you describe him, it was a surprise that he went in that direction.
A total surprise, because he had grown up in a socialist family. Socialism was, by the way, a little more respectable in the 1930s than it was in the 1940s and 1950s. So he grew up in a socialist family. He was sort of a populist guy, and he was swept into office as governor of Arkansas, and he was a racial moderate. Which meant that he supported the Brown decision. And, in fact, Arkansas was one of the first states to have school districts develop plans, including in Little Rock. But in 1956, he encountered a very strong push from the right in the primary election for governor. He was running for re-election. He felt that, hey, in this atmosphere, I'm not going to win a second term unless I get on board the segregationist train, which he did, and which he did whole hog, as they say in Arkansas.
Well, and fast-forwarding a little bit from Eisenhower to LBJ, you have a number of sobering statistics in this book. One of them is this. In 1965, during LBJ's Great Society, 71% of Americans trusted Congress most of the time. By 2013, that number was 20%. How can that number be reversed, assuming that you believe it can?
Oh, definitely. I'm an optimist, and I think this book ultimately is an optimist's book in that it provides a blueprint for how we can get out of it, and how we can get out of it in two ways. One is to revive the activist government, and two, not only revive an activist government, but to ensure that it works for everyone, not just for a privileged few.
Along those lines, staying with LBJ, you know, so much has been done, Robert Cairo alone, obviously, but in terms of figuring out his legacy and his presidency. We just had the Ken Burns Vietnam War miniseries, which obviously shows the worst end of the Johnson presidency. How do you see LBJ full picture?
On the whole, LBJ had a positive impact on America that lasted and last to this day, particularly in terms of his war on poverty, particularly in terms of environmental legislation, particularly in terms of civil rights legislation. It's just incomparable what he accomplished. The tragedy was that he dissipated a great deal of this through his efforts in the Vietnam War, which you could see coming because throughout his Senate career and even before then as a congressman, he was very hawkish and very supportive of military incursions in areas that we should not have gone into. So you could see this. In fact, he was very upset with President Eisenhower in 1957 when the Soviets launched the Sputnik satellite. Johnson wanted some retaliation against the Soviets because he felt, well, they're going to establish a base on the moon and they're going to rain rockets on us and God knows what. And Eisenhower said, look, the moon is safe for the time being. And instead what Eisenhower did, he poured money into education. And that's really the difference between, say, a George W. Bush's reaction to 9/11 and a reaction. Well,
and that's what I was going to ask you about. That passage in the book struck me. You point out that George W. Bush responded to the 9/11 attacks by going to war, and I think you write that it will take 50 years perhaps to correct that, whereas Eisenhower went for education and science. What would be comparable for Donald Trump to do in the right way, if he could look at something to invest in instead of, you know, maybe pursuing foreign wars. And I realize he has not gotten into a foreign war. I'm not saying that, but you know,
right. Well, I think it's not only Donald Trump. I think it's the atmosphere in Washington today that makes it very difficult for Congress to act. I mean, you see Congress is just as dysfunctional as the White House is. We have so many needs, but I think education is really prominent and foremost. We need to ratchet up our support for education to the level it was in the 1950s. Look at what we accomplished as a result. I think we need immigration reform. I think we need infrastructure. If you go to airports, if you drive our highways, the U.S. is a third world country. We used to be first to the future. Now we're back in the pack. In terms of indexes of civilization that are put out by the U.N., we're down around Slovenia. And with all due respect to all you Slovenian listeners, that's not
please
a place
keep listening.
We should be in.
Well, and the thing, and this is no novel insight, but you've heard it for years and years, it seems like infrastructure in particular is not a Republican or Democratic issue. It seems like one that would be a winner for anybody in office. Donald Trump even campaigned on it. So with that one in particular, why has there not been greater success?
One problem is, of course, the deficit that large infrastructure projects. Eisenhower basically built the pyramids with building the interstate highway system. It was the greatest public works project in American history up to that time and including up to now. So as a result, it definitely increased the deficit, but we had a tax structure that provided revenue to the government. We don't have that now.
Let me leave that as a cliffhanger. That is Professor David Goldfield, the author of The Gifted Generation, When Government Was Good. He'll be back to talk about that and Confederate monuments when we come back on Charlotte Talks.
Charlotte Talks' look at the gifted generation continues in a moment. Dr. David Goldfield will continue this conversation tonight at Park Road Books at the Park Road Shopping Center. He'll be there from 7 to 8:30. Support today comes from WFAE members and Hendrick Volkswagen of Concord, offering 250 new and certified used Volkswagens. Details at Hendrick Volkswagen of Concord at the Concord Mills exit or HendrickVWofConcord.com. And from Duke Energy, investing in technology designed to modernize the Carolinas energy grid over the next 10 years. More at duke-energy.com/future. While Washington's attention is on taxes, Roy Moore and Al Franken, the Russia investigation continues. It has turned up communications between Donald Trump Jr. and WikiLeaks. Coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock, On Point and guest host Jane Clayson will have the latest on the Russia probe and the death of cult leader Charles Manson. That's coming up after Charlotte Talks here on 90.7 WFAE.
Between the time your feet hit the floor in the morning and the time your cereal hits the bowl, the news can change.
We don't know what the charges are.
The allegations became public. Harvey Weinstein said he was going to take a leave.
Driving a rented Home Depot pickup truck entered the West Side Highway.
When it does, Morning Edition keeps you up to date with reliable, fact-based, efficient reporting. Wake up with Morning Edition every day.
Listen weekday mornings from 5 to 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
Back on Charlotte Talks with Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. My guest today is David Goldfield. He is a professor of history at UNC Charlotte. He is also the author of The Gifted Generation, When Government Was Good. When we broke away, you were talking a little bit about infrastructure and how Eisenhower, of course, developed the interstate system and some of the reasons why it's more difficult now for Congress and the White House to take on those kinds of projects.
But the federal government does not have the revenue stream that we had in the 1950s. When Eisenhower was president, the highest tax bracket was 90%. And as a result, we had much less income inequality.
As opposed to 35% now.
Right. And it may be lower.
Right. Effective tax rate.
The bill is about 20%, I think.
Yes.
So the tax structure supported these systems. The key to keep in mind is that we have a consumer economy. And if you put money into consumers' pockets as opposed to putting money into corporations, there is no professional economist that I know of who will guarantee that a lower corporate tax structure, lower taxes on the extremely wealthy will create jobs and grow the economy. I don't see the research. However, if you put money into consumers' pockets, they will consume. John Kenneth Galbraith called this the virtuous circle of growth. That is, government provides the tax structure. Government provides services that individuals and groups cannot provide by themselves. By the way, that's a direct quote from Abraham Lincoln that dates back 150 years. As a result, consumers drive the economy, creating more jobs, creating more consumer spending, and the economy goes along as well. What we have today is a much more exclusive government. It's not that government has disappeared. It's that government functions also as an exclusive repository for the very well-to-do and the very well-connected. Income inequality doesn't affect you and me and anybody out there listening to this program, but it does affect access to government, and that is the problem.
You mentioned access to government. It's interesting when you talk about LBJ and the Voting Rights Act, the Great Society, much like infrastructure, things that you thought in many ways might have already been conquered, maybe have not been, because when we look at voting and some of the many lawsuits and controversies going on about access to the ballot, it's clear that it has not been resolved. Let's start with Johnson when he made his address to Congress right here.
But there is cause for hope and for faith in our democracy and what is happening here tonight. For the cries of pain and the hymns and protests of oppressed people have summoned into convocation all the majesty of this great government, the government of the greatest nation on earth. Our mission is at once the oldest and the most basic of this country: to right wrong, to do justice, to serve man. In our time, we have come to live with the moments of great crisis. Our lives have been marked with debate about great issues, issues of war and peace, issues of prosperity and depression. But rarely in any time does an issue lay bare the secret heart of America itself. Rarely are we met with a challenge not to our growth, our abundance, or our welfare, or our security, but rather to the values and the purposes and the meaning of our beloved nation. The issue of equal rights for American Negroes is such an issue. And should we defeat every enemy, and should we double our wealth and conquer the stars and still be unequal to this issue, then we will have failed as a people and as a nation.
What would it take for a president to find similar success on fairness in education or housing or health care or even voting in our era?
The important thing to keep in mind about presidents, particularly Eisenhower and Johnson, was that often they were ahead of public opinion. Even Truman, in 1946, when he proposed the first civil rights legislation since the Reconstruction era, right after the Civil War, 6% of Americans felt that civil rights was an important issue. So, and if you take the South out of it, okay, Southern whites were not that excited about it. But if you take the South out of it, it's 21%. But that's still a minority position. And yet Truman said this was important. In 1964, just as LBJ was proposing the 1964 Civil Rights Act, a majority of Americans felt that, oh, okay, you know, African Americans, you've made your point. Now the time is to get lost, basically. And in terms of the Voting Rights Act, the same thing. So our general public has sometimes been more conservative, has often been more conservative than our presidents. And the general public mostly functions in the center. And sometimes our presidents are successful if they can move a little bit from the center and move a little left and work for the entire Commonwealth rather than just one segment for it. Johnson's mantra was always, I'm giving African Americans the opportunity for equality. But that's not only going to help African Americans, that's going to help the entire country. You know, always framed his legislation, the fact that this is not a measure for Negroes, as he would say. This is a measure for all Americans, because he believed with all his heart that if we are true to our founding ideals, this will make us a better nation, not only for the target, but for the entire population.
You mentioned the Commonwealth. The Commonwealth ideal is a big theme in your book. Maybe share with people what you mean by that.
Sure. The Commonwealth ideal is an idea that government functions best when it levels the playing field. Government functions best when it works from the center. And the center often requires compromise. Our government works best from compromise. And you see what happens when we cannot compromise. We had a civil war, for example. I don't see that happening now, although we are a pretty contentious bunch. But we don't have that flavor of compromise. We don't have this broader picture. And I think these three presidents, Truman, Eisenhower, and Johnson, had this broader picture because they went through the fire and were annealed as a result. They went through the Great Depression. They went through the Second World War. They saw the good that government could do. And because they saw the good that government could do, they wanted that for all Americans, even if all Americans were not on board with the specific programs.
Well, and that point I want to ask you about in particular, because in the book you talk about Truman, Eisenhower, and LBJ had all seen government work. Truman and LBJ both went to Washington in the 30s. Eisenhower, of course, went through the experience of World War II, mobilizing the country. And I want to ask you about the flip side of that, though. So now we have a generation or two of politicians who've been through Vietnam. They've been through Watergate. They've been through Iran-Contra. They've been through the Clinton impeachment. And Are those things weighing on them in a damaging way that is chipping away at the effectiveness of our federal government?
Absolutely, because beginning in the 1970s, of course, you had the Vietnam and Watergate. You had the economic crisis with the oil embargo in 1973. Many Americans, both left and right, felt that the government really wasn't working for them. What we needed at that time was a leader to stand up and say, okay, it's time to take Washington back. It's time to make the government work for everyone again, as we were during our glory days of the 1940s, 50s, and 60s. Instead, we got Jimmy Carter. And Jimmy Carter had the greatest post-presidency that any president ever had. But as president, he wanted to downsize. They say that a president has to be larger than life, and Jimmy Carter was smaller than life. Theodore Lowy, a great political scientist, said that Richard Nixon was the last Democratic president. Of course, Richard Nixon was a Republican. But when you look at Nixon's record, particularly on the environment, he established the Environmental Protection Agency, you can see that Nixon did believe in an active government. But with Jimmy Carter and then ultimately with Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan was famous for saying, or infamous for saying, that the nine most terrifying words in the English language is, "Hi, I'm from the government. I'm here to help you." He didn't appreciate the irony of presiding over a government that he was trashing.
Right. I'm sure history would never repeat itself. Along those lines, in terms of believing in government, one of the interesting portraits that you have in this book is one of former Mayor Harvey Gantt, who, of course, was the first African-American mayor in Charlotte, elected in 1983. 20 years before that, he integrated Clemson University. And you talk about how Harvey Gantt grew up in Charleston, poor family, segregated schools, and lifted himself up in the world in part not only by his tremendous ability, but some of these things that were going on in government. How do we reconcile his story with the troubling trends we discussed earlier that minorities and other groups still face?
Harvey Gantt was fortunate to be part of what I call the gifted generation. That is, the government provides the opportunity, and you go out and grab it. And what Harvey Gantt did is he said in an interview, his family was poor, beyond poor, growing up actually in an island outside of Charleston. They did eventually move to the mainland. But he had some good support services. He had a very strong family bond. He had strong religious institutions. He had very good teachers, even in the segregated high schools. Those institutions are much less available to African Americans. In fact, it's irony that it's a reflection of the success of African Americans. One of the great stories, one of the great undertold stories of this period is the rapid expansion of the black middle class. Well, what happened when the black middle class expanded? They left many of these neighborhoods, thereby depressing them and thereby wiping out the type of drive, the type of ambition that is necessary for coming out of these communities.
You're listening to Professor David Goldfield from UNC Charlotte. He is the author of the new book, The Gifted Generation, When Government Was Good. I mentioned earlier in the show that you've spent a lot of your career writing about not only race relations, but the Civil War. Given your extensive study in these aspects of our history, how surprising is Charlottesville to you when you have neo-Nazis and white nationalists who are violently protesting the removal of a Robert E. Lee statue?
Not surprising at all, because these groups and these ideas have been around for decades. It's just that now, particularly with the current administration, they feel, I have support. Washington has my back, just like we felt growing up in Brooklyn that Washington had my back. So that's not surprising in itself. But we are having a debate about our history and the best way to display it. For some people, particularly African Americans, seeing these statues in prominent public places is very disconcerting. It's very sad. For others, hey, I'm not a racist. I didn't own slaves. This is my history, and it should be displayed. So it's a very difficult controversy.
The social justice and legal activist Brian Stevenson, I remember when he was in Charlotte in the last couple of years, he talked about how Germany, for example, came to a much quicker reckoning with its history and put it in much clearer context. Why do you think America has struggled in that regard?
Well, first of all, let's clear this. The Confederate States of America is not Nazi Germany.
Right. I wasn't trying to say that. I don't think he was.
And it bothers me when people like Bruce Stevenson make that comparison, because it is very different. Yeah, Germany has done very well. If you go to Germany now, you'll see Nazi flags all over the place, but they're in museums and Nazi memorabilia. For a movement that rebelled against the United States of America, my country, I think the museum is an appropriate place. They are part of our history, but I think they should be placed in historical context.
That is Professor David Goldfield. He is at UNC Charlotte. He's the author of The Gifted Generation, When Government Was Good. Professor Goldfield, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you, Eric. It's been a pleasure.
And I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins, and thanks for listening to Charlotte Talks.